Scott Cullen is with TSN Analytics and a fantasy analyst in our building. And he is out on TSN.ca with his mid-season NHL awards. I do also want to throw in a plug. He is a regular on Four Downs, which can be heard on TSN 1050 each and every Saturday. Skriz wanted me to get that in. And as I've said, if Uncle Shawnee threw it down on my little list of things to promote, see, this is where it's Friday. I can throw the producer under the bus. I'd be all over the Four Downs talk, Skriz.
Your toonie's coming in the mail.
Is it?
Scotty, thank you.
What will that get me? Doesn't even get you a cup of coffee anymore. I need a toonie and a loonie. How are you, my man?
I'm good. How you doing, Scott?
Good. So I'm going into attack mode
right
off the bat. Why isn't Austin Matthews' name on your list of Hart nominees? Pierre Maguire asked me to ask you. No, I'm just kidding.
Well,
You've got Crosby, McDavid, and Tarasenko.
That's right.
Good choices.
And look, obviously Austin Matthews is awful. but no, and honestly, if he didn't go through the slump that he went through, right? Like, his production lately would have him up there, right? Like, he has 15 goals in the last 20 games, I think, and he's playing like one of these elite franchise players right now. And so, while I don't have him on my list here at the midway point of the season, it's not inconceivable to me that he is a guy who gets there by the end, because basically, to me, it's a two-horse race, right? It's a Crosby McDavid thing. They're the best two players in the game right now for my money. But if Matthews kind of continues and has a strong second half, I think it really opens up after those two. Like, I have Vladimir Tarasenko there, but you can argue half a dozen guys with me, and I'm pretty open to changing who's the next runner-up after McDavid, because I don't think anyone else has really separated from the pack in the same way that Crosby and McDavid have.
When you consider this stuff, mm-hmm. Scotty, are you strictly looking at stats and advanced metrics, or if we get to the end of the season and the Maple Leafs have somehow made the playoffs, and I throw somehow in there because I think, well, my heart tells me they've got a shot. My head is telling me I see them playing games of consequence into March, but I think they're going to fall short. That's just what my sense of this whole thing is, and I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. If they get in, And Austin continues to perform at this level through the second half of the season, when typically games get more intense and on it goes, does the team success factor into your decision making, or are you strictly focused on individual contribution?
Yeah, I'm pretty agnostic on the team thing, because in some ways, that gives a real advantage to the guys who have strong teams around them, right? Like, if you go back to last year's Norris Trophy debate, Drew Doughty was, he's the backbone of this great LA Kings team, and he is, but Erik Karlsson is doing this stuff with, a patchwork Ottawa Senators lineup around him, and that's almost more admirable. Maybe not almost. It is more admirable. It's harder work that Erik Karlsson had to do. And so, if you said, the Leafs come and they get within a couple points of the playoffs, but Austin Matthews has 40 goals and 78 points or something and has played this well all the way through the season, he might be a guy who still warrants that, at least in my mind. I know the way the public votes and the way these things kind of skew, but for me, I'm much more on the individual contribution.
Because I'm thinking it's fair to say if the Leafs get in,
a huge part of it.
He's going to have to be the guy.
Yeah.
I love Marner, and I obviously see Nylander's skill, and there are holes on the back end and all this stuff. But if they get in, it's because their number one centerman at 19 years old was brilliant. You do have him at the front of the Calder race right now. And I'm just a second here. Oh, my phone's charging back there. I wanted to text Gary Lawless and say, Scotty Cullen has Austin Matthews ahead of Patrick Laine in the Calder race. And you also have Zach Werenski's name listed.
Yeah, and you know what? I had there was a while back when Gary had that piece where he was all excited about Patrick Laine compared to Austin Matthews, and we did on TSN Analytics. We asked, who would you prefer? I said, it's a slam dunk for Austin Matthews. And this isn't, look, Patrick Laine might be a guy who scores 500 or 600 goals in this league. Like, he is a great shooter. But Austin Matthews, he generates more shots. And they're from great scoring areas. Like, if you look at his shot chart, it's everything is in front of the net. And, you know, Laine is scoring, and he's scoring on 20% of his shots, and he's shooting from 35 feet out, which is extremely rare. Like, it's remarkable that he's scored the way he has. Matthews is scoring from places you expect a guy to score from. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, should repeat. And now what you've seen is that Matthews already has as many goals as Laine. And you go, well, if he already scores as much as he does, well, the Leafs control play more with Matthews on the ice. He creates more scoring chances. Like, he's a more complete player.
The demands of his position as well at both ends of the ice are greater just naturally because he's a centerman.
Yeah. And so, you know, while there was that kind of brief moment where, you know, Laine, you know, jumped out on the goal scoring lead and everybody started to wonder, to me, I've been, you know, firmly in Matthews' corner because the stuff that he is doing already is, you know, completely sustainable. The kind of like I don't expect that we're going to see Austin Matthews generating all these shots as a 19-year-old all of a sudden at 20 or 21 can't find the net. Like, the goals are just going to keep following because he keeps generating a lot of shots.
Scott Cullen is with us, TSN Analytics, TSN 1050's Four Downs. That's for you, Scrizz. I get the thumbs up. You know, this is the guy who controls. He's the guy who controls the off button. So if I'm going to talk while the microphone's on, I better do it right. And he's TSN.ca's fantasy analyst out on TSN.ca with his midseason NHL awards. The Brent Burns story fascinates the heck out of me, Scotty, because he has always been an offensively gifted player, back to his days in Minnesota. But there were periods of time both in Minnesota and in his early days in San Jose where he couldn't hold his job on the blue line. He was shuttled up to play right wing.
Yep.
And now he has come around and become a complete player as a defenseman. And you have him ahead of Victor Hedman and Shea Weber. I want to talk about Shea Weber as well, right? Because that trade was not without its share of controversy at the time, especially in the analytics community. You have Brent Burns at the front of the Norris Trophy race.
I do, and you know what? The funny thing is, a few years ago when they moved him up to play right wing on Joe Thornton's line, and he was really good. Like, you know, this 6'5" guy who just barreled in on the forecheck and created turnovers and got lots of scoring opportunities. And everybody's like, wow, they have this really great asset to play on Joe Thornton's wing. And then they moved him back to defense. And there were, you know, I think there was a lot of hesitation there. Like, you know what you have with him up front, and you're still going to make the decision to put him back on defense. And what they've found is that like, Brent Burns is kind of an attack dog for their defense. You know, he jumps into the rush. He creates scoring chances. Like, he's leading the league in shots per game. You know, like, that's just kind of unheard of for a defenseman in the modern times, that you know, that he's generating four shots on goal per game. And I mean, there was a game earlier this year he had 22 shot attempts, right? There were times in the playoffs last year where you can see it's like, they get the puck in the offensive zone, and Burns is ready to one-time it, no matter who has it. And usually it's Thornton. And Thornton, since he refuses to shoot, you know, Burns is the guy who's kind of cocked and ready to create those chances for them. And so the fact that he's creating all this offensively, scoring more than a point per game, that's why, you know, that's what separates him from the pack. But, you know, he has sort of evolved as a defenseman. You know, he's not just a forward back there. And so, like, he's... And part of it, too, is that the rest of the defensive class hasn't really been terrific. Like, Hedman has had a good year, and his offense has picked up, so I feel good about including him there. But Weber had a phenomenal start, right?
Habs were red hot.
Goals and points. The Habs got off to a great start. And at the first quarter point of the season, he was my Norris Trophy guy, basically because you couldn't help it. He had just done so much in the first quarter. But, you know, his production started to come off a little bit, and, you know, by season's end, I don't expect that he's still going to be there. You know, it's not that he's played poorly for Montreal, but he's not going to be the guy he was for the first 20 games. That's just a super hot streak that guys go through.
So I'm looking at the Selke, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, this is kind of the one that makes you snore or goes underappreciated, right? Because it's best defensive forward. And a lot of the names that we see here, Patrice Bergeron, Anje Kopitar, these are guys who've won that award before and deservedly so. They're 200-foot hockey players, quote-unquote. You've got Andrew Cogliano, which is an interesting name, a left-winger playing for the Anaheim Ducks, now the ex-Edmonton Oiler. How do you... Because it used to be about plus minus, right?
Yeah, and yeah.
Guy got X number of points, was a pretty good offensive player, but had a plus 20, plus 30, was always on for more even strength goals than goals against. How do you measure who's appropriate for the Selke Trophy?
So I don't use plus minus anymore.
I know.
Yeah. What I'll look at is I'll look at Corsi, which is basically a plus minus for shots. And so that's kind of the first criteria. But I'll also look at how that is relative to his teammates. So the reason Bergeron wins this award year after year and why I almost automatically put him down is the Bruins are always out shooting the opposition with Bergeron on the ice. And compared to what it's like when Bergeron is off the ice, it's just a dramatic, dramatic difference. Like, it's a 60-40 tilt for the Bruins when Bergeron's on the ice. Rest of the time, it might be 50-50, 48-52. Like, it's just a huge, huge difference to have Bergeron on the ice. And so that's why he's the guy. But in addition to, you know, tracking those things, there are some quality of competition metrics you can see. You can see who's getting sheltered and who is really facing the toughest opposition. Again, Bergeron is the guy who always faces the other team's top line. And you can see where coaches put them out for faceoffs. And while there are a ton of changes that happen on the fly and coaches don't have any control over that, if you see that the coach keeps wanting this guy out in the defensive zone, you know, he trusts him defensively. And look, we know they trust Patrice Bergeron defensively. But when you're, you know, getting 60% of the shots and you're starting your shifts in the defensive zone, like, it's just a really complete game. And the reason I kind of point out in this article is that Bergeron and Kopitar are two guys who do this fairly regularly, right? They control play, they take on the tough assignments and start in the defensive zone. But neither one is really scoring much this year. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, in past years with the Selke, it used to be, well, you know, you're looking for a guy who scores a little bit. You know, Jonathan Toews is one of those guys. He scores 60, 70 points, and you know, well, he's a good two-way player, so that gets him a Selke Award. But the way Bergeron and Kopitar are kind of dominating play, even though they're not putting up points, you know, they're still sort of my go-to guys in that. And in the case of Cogliano, they have a line in Anaheim with him, Ryan Kessler, and Jacob Silverberg, that, you know, they're a real dominant line, and they get stuck with the tough matchups, right? Like Getzlaff and Perry and Raquel, they're put out there in offensive situations. They don't have to do the heavy lifting defensively. That goes to the line with Cogliano and Kessler.
Last one for you. Jack Adams Award. And I like your three selections here because they all have different recent backgrounds. You have John Tortorella, who is on the bounce back in Columbus. You have Joel Quenneville, who would, I think, get consistently overlooked for this because people will say, well, he coaches the Chicago Blackhawks and they've got a great team and have been great for years and have won a bunch of cups. And this is an award typically handed out to people like the next guy on your list, Mike Babcock, who is coaching an upstart. And a team like the Maple Leafs are probably a little bit ahead of where we expected they would be.
That's right. Exceeding expectations is the big thing.
And if you sneak into the playoffs, you become the popular choice.
It is. And the one thing that Jack Adams has been like a death sentence for coaches in recent years, in part because I think people vote for it incorrectly. They find a team that has been riding percentages, right? So Patrick Waugh wins when Semyon Varlamov has a great season, and you know, and then the Avalanche go in the tank. And it's like, well, Patrick Waugh hasn't changed his coaching over that time. His goaltending just got back to normal, and so those results fell off. And so I'm looking for coaches that aren't totally determined by their goaltending, for one thing, but also, you know, outrageously favorable percentages in either way. In the case of Tortorella, he does have good goaltending. Bobrovsky's playing really well for them. But the Blue Jackets also have the best power play in the league, and after about the first month of the season, they've been one of the top possession teams, you know, one of the top half dozen teams. And given that they started the season, they were a subpar possession team, I kind of look at that bit of progress. I kind of give some credit to coaching for that. You know, like when Pittsburgh last year, when they went from their coach, Mike Johnston, and they brought in Mike Sullivan, their possession numbers skyrocketed, like almost immediately. And so you kind of have to give Mike Sullivan some credit for that. And like whatever he is doing with that team to turn them loose, it worked. And so in Tortorella's case, you know, I mean, he was expected to be the first coach fired if you looked at the sports books before the season. Then he takes a team on a 16-game winning streak, and yeah, there's some good fortune involved in doing that, but you have to give credit where it's due. And so he ends up being the guy. But in the case of Babcock, like you say, like as much as, like, I was a little bit optimistic about the Leafs coming into the year. I think I ranked them 22nd, you know, after finishing 30th. I thought that's some good improvement. But had no idea that the rookies would be this good. And for the team to be this good with this many rookies playing prominent roles, that's kind of my reasoning for liking Mike Babcock. Like, that you can get a playoff team where you're, you know, 7-8 rookies playing on a regular basis. That's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, he's coaching them up. And that's exactly what he was brought in here to do. And that was the challenge he faced, at least in the early part of this rebuild, in the early part of that 8-year contract he signed. Thanks for this. It was a lot of fun. We'll get you in here again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, man.